My message is of Abram at war and blessed, and often those two things don't work together. And we're going to be looking at the entire chapter of chapter 14 of Genesis. Let me take you to verses 1 through 7 as we find here the approach of war. And I found this fascinating just on a historical level. You open up the Bible and here it is, and now by reading this, we have an idea. I don't know. I try to put myself into these situations. I try to imagine that I'm living in that day and try to look around and see what I see. And maybe not so much smell what I smell. It's an agricultural area after all. But I try to imagine it. I try to be there. I try to listen to their speech. And this tells us a number of things. Here's the passage, verses 1 through 7. And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar. We met Shinar back when we were talking about Nimrod building, or at least in charge of the place where the Tower of Babel was built. And the word Shinar is a plain, a level area, and it's between the Tigris and Euphrates. This is the area that would become Babylon. Babylonia. Also Arioch, king of Elasar. We don't know anything about Elasar. Chedorlaomer, king of Elam. This is where Persia would end up. And Tidal, king of nations. This is the general word for Gentiles, but in one sense, everybody but Abraham is a Gentile at this point. So this seems to be probably a collection of tribes, that he was a king over that. That these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, with Shinab, king of Admah, and with Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela. Now, we don't get his name, but the city was called Bela, which is Zoar. Later, it was called Zoar. I think Zoar comes from the name of it being a little place, and Lot flees to that with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. All these were joined together in the Vale of Siddim, which is the Salt Sea. Now, the Vale of Siddim is where the Salt Sea, where the Dead Sea is now. After the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, the very ground was blown up, and that the Dead Sea is such a low spot that no water runs out of it. That's what makes it dead and a collection of salt. Now here's the past history. 12 years they're in that fertile area where the Dead Sea is now, 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year came Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him and smote. And here's their procedure as they come down through Canaan. They smote the Rephaim, those are the giants, in Ashtaroth Karnim. This is actually crossing over the Jordan. And the Zuzim, another word for giants, in Ham. And the Imims, a third name for the giants, in Shava Kiriathim, or perhaps the plain of Kiriathim. And then the non-giants, the Horites, in their Mount Seir, unto El Paran, or the plain of Paran, which is by the wilderness. And they returned, came back over the Jordan, and they came to En Mishpat, which is Kadesh. At Moses writing this, that was known as Kadesh, but back then it was called En Mishpat. And smote all the country of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites that dwelt in Hazezon-Tamar. We're going to meet some other Amorites that they did not smite, but those who lived in that area, they smote. So what we recognize here is that Moses wrote these words. The time of these kings were long past. We don't hear of these kings again. The situation, however, as I'm pointing out, tells us much of the times. Mesopotamia, survived the fiasco of the Tower of Babel, and Nimrod's power-hungry kingdom broke apart, but it continued to some degree under the king Amraphel. We see he leads the list in the days of. So he might have been the most powerful. He might have had the greatest kingdom, but rulers have now divided Mesopotamia into the several different kingdoms. It is Chedorlaomer, however, of Elam, the area of Persia, that seems to lead the military force. Title King of the Nations, as I spoke, seems to be one leader over perhaps a group of smaller nations, smaller tribes. Each tribal unit was its own nation. The Bible does not mention them again. Now, 14 years earlier than our story, some representation of these four kingdoms had invaded Canaan and come to the Vale of Siddim, where the Dead Sea, the Salt Sea, is now, and they found it a prosperous place. The cities were making money by trading with the agricultural people. Things were for sale there. The Vale, they demanded some tribute of the people and or money. We don't know what they were asking for. They wanted slaves to come back and work for them, but being a wealthy area, they probably asked for, you know, goods and money, silver, gold, whatever. We don't know what they asked for, but somehow they were under tribute. They were under the servitude of these countries. So each year, somebody from this area would show up saying, "Where's my protection money?" And people would hand it over to them, and they would take it back, say, "Okay, check it off. They're obedient." But time came, and they rebelled. "Go back and tell him that we're not going to give him this anymore." This tells me that travel over such long distances was quite common, even though it was still difficult. If you have an army group, if you have a protection group around you, you can travel all of these distances. So the people now in this story, these four kings and their group that come up, I'll do it from your side, for the mount down in Persia area, up the Tigris and Euphrates. They came up to the area of Syria, like where Haran was, and then they come down Canaan. They cross over the Jordan and then back and come down. While they're doing that, you have to imagine what they're like. This isn't, you know, just 50 soldiers. This is a great group. And wherever they stop at night, they have to stop and eat. And so they have people with them. They, besides being fierce soldiers, they have people that are cooking. They have people that are keeping animals that are bit by bit being eaten. All of this is happening as they travel up the military route, the Fertile Crescent trade route. So it's a large self-sufficient unit. You catch this idea that later in the battle, a great deal is taken from them. And we see why they would have it, because this was a large self-sufficient group in itself. Now, when they defeated a people, they took everything they needed. So they resupplied all their food supplies. They brought in the wheat or took the bread or whatever it was. And they also took anything that they liked to take back home, to come back with luxury, beautiful things, crafty things, inventive things, whatever it was, you know, whatever these people had. Now, we turn our attention to where Abram is living And Lot actually chose the coastal plain. He came to this valley of Siddim, and that area was characterized by five separate kingdoms. Again, a kingdom is a large tribe with a king, and each one had its own city. So this is a city-state. Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, and Bela are the five cities of this area, and that seems to go north to south. At any rate, Bela, after the judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah, was called Zoar, meaning a little place, insignificant. So to get down there, the southern third of Canaan, the army moved as Abram had up that Fertile Crescent and then came down. It was a great military as well as a trade route. They came in beside Damascus, which still exists now in what's called Syria. Now, about the middle of Canaan, they crossed over the Jordan into what we call at the time of Christ, Perea, which simply means the byway, the place where people would cross over, so they didn't have to go, the Jews didn't have to go through Samaria. They crossed over, there was Perea. But there, that's where the giants were living. That's where they smote the Rephaim, the Zuzim, the Emims. Those were all giants, and the Horites were also there. The Bible does not explain why they attacked them. Did these giants see that they were coming? Here's an invading army, and we'll go squash them, we'll go fight them. I don't know whether they fought in defense or whether they just attacked them for greater profit. You know, that's what they were doing down there. I don't know. The Horites had come from the mountains of Seir, where Edom was going to settle later. The Horites were still there in the mountains when the Edomites came and conquered and exterminated them. Now we find that they came down, these conquerors came, crossed back over into Canaan proper and came down to the place that was the older name for Kadesh, Kadesh Barnea, at the south. But they're ready to move over into the coastal area where the Vale of Siddim is. So that was the approach of war. Wealthy people like Abram had people all over. They were selling their crops and their flock and buying things and all this type of thing. So this was not happening isolated. Like I say, it was a large, self-sufficient army troop marching through the land. Everybody in the area would know this and be put on alert. But we find, secondly, the arrival of war in verses 8 through 12. And here's this passage. There went out the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah and the king of Admah and the king of Zeboim and king of Bela, the name is the same as Zoar, and they joined battle with them in the Vale of Siddim. So they had rebelled. They knew this was probably coming. If they had the power to come back, they would come back. And now they go out to fight. And who were they fighting with? With Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, with Tidal, king of nations, Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elisar, four kings with five. Now, in those days, the king didn't sit on a throne in pretty robes. He was the guy that led him in battle. And he became the king because he could do this most effectively. Now, the problem is that the Vale of Siddim was full of slime pits. This is the word that is translated that means pit of asphalt, pit of tar, tar pits. And the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there. I think that means they fell into the tar pits. That's a bad way to go. You know, it's like sinking sand in tar. And they that remained fled to the mountain, they who avoided the slime pits. So now they conquered that army of city people. They conquered them. And it says, verse 11, they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals, all their food items, all food stores, and went their way. They turn and they start going back. Now, and they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt, here we find he was actually living in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. We're going to find that they leave that vale, that valley, and they travel north up to close to Damascus. Now, I don't know how that would go. My guess is that many of them would take something and move ahead. There would be those scouts ahead. They've got a lot of stuff with them now. So the people carrying that, many of the slaves themselves probably, and carrying the food stores, they would all go slowly. If you have a whole group of men and women who are now going to be your slaves, that's all moving slowly. These aren't soldier types. So I'm guessing it was either strung out quite a bit or separated groups. But they departed. So these conquerors brought the battle to the kings, put them to flight. Not much is described about this battle. It doesn't seem like that these citified veil livers had much good in the way of fighting. So they just plundered all the cities and carried it off. Here's the interesting thing. I mean, sad, but interesting. Lot chose the coastal area because it was so lush, good for crops, good for his flocks. He set his tents facing Sodom. Now we find that he was living in Sodom. This was a good place for business. He was getting more stuff. The conquerors come, take him, his family, all his stuff, and take it away. What about Abram, who got left with the hill country? They didn't bother him. It doesn't say why, but he was not, you know, in one place. He didn't have walled cities for them to knock down and conquer. He was spread out. The very fact that he lived like that, still in tents and so on, meant that it was harder for them to attack. It'd all be open field and climbing up hills while they're at the top of the hill throwing things down at you, like spears and arrows and stuff. So isn't that, you know, interesting? Lot chooses for the stuff and gets it all taken away. Not once, but twice. Once here, and once again when God takes it all away. The conquerors turn back for home, travel up the Jordan Valley up to Damascus. They don't bother Abram, though we've been told he was a person of great wealth. As I say, it just didn't seem like it was worth their time to search all that out. Now, we also find that Abram had his own coalition of neighbors who would join in the battle. I find that interesting. As much of a pilgrim as a stranger he was, he still recognized his neighbors. He was still dealing with them. He was still interacting with them. And we find, because of this, we have the third point, and that is the reprisal for war. And this is verses 13 to 16. There came one that had escaped and told Abram, the Hebrew. This is the first time he's called that. In fact, it's the first time this word is used to describe the people. For he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite. Here's an Amorite, brother of Eshcol, brother of Aner, and these were confederate with Abram. Confederate, friends. They had a confederacy together. And when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive by this one that escaped, he armed or led forth his trained or instructed servants born in his own house. These are slaves. He doesn't have children yet. These are all slaves, but they're ready to take up arms for him, and they've been trained for this. See? 318. Now, it sounds like a pretty good army to raise for your, out of your own house. However, I don't think this is anything like that confederacy of four kings that came down marching through Canaan, beating giants and wiping out the Vale of Siddim. I'm guessing they had thousands, but 318, and pursued them unto Dan. This is at the northern part. And he divided himself against them, he and his servants, by night, and smote them, and pursued them unto Hobah, which is on the left hand, and they tell me that could mean the north of Damascus. He won. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot and his goods, and the women also, and the people. He got it all. He came back triumphant. What do we learn from this? Well, you know, as I said before, it's not likely that Abram had remained unaware of the invading army. I think his preparations were in place. The one thing that he hadn't heard in all of that mess, all that confusion, was that Lot and his family had been captured and taken. I wonder about this lone figure. It says, came one that had escaped. The Hebrew is a little more definite. It's the one. So one escaped. Everybody else was taken. It made me wonder how that happened and why this one that escaped came to Abram. Why would he do that? See? So my imagination takes over, and I'm asking myself, who is this person? Why did he go to Abram with this information? What did he expect from Abram? I think that this escapee was one of Lot's people. And as things are falling apart, Lot says, go hide yourself. Where? Under that pile of garbage. They're never going to look there. I'm making this up, you understand. And so he crawls under all the plastic bags and waits there. And trembling, trying not to breathe in the fumes, and finally, they're gone. And he waits some more, and some more, and then he comes out, and he peeks around, and he looks. And I don't know whether they had coffee grounds or what, but he you know, wipes himself off, and now he does what Lot had told him to do. Probably something like, tell my uncle Abram that they've taken us. What did Lot expect? Well, I don't know, but he knew Abram would not take this lightly. They had been together. Lot had been growing up under the care of Abram. We saw last time that he is called Lot, who was with Abram. You know, this is how he became who he was. And he knew Lot wouldn't, or Lot knew that Abram wouldn't leave him undefended if it was all possible. This also tells me that Abram was a man of his times. This could be a dangerous time. Every tribe that got any strength became its own nation. And they could easily come and attack you. So he had in place preparation for possible invasion. Notice that he kept his identity separate. He's Abraham the Hebrew. The emphasis of that, I think, and the commentators kind of divided on this, but Martin Luther and some others agree with me, that it meant he was a descendant of Eber. If you work out the genealogy and how long they lived, you find that Eber lived a very long time, and if you always called the people by the name of the eldest man for hundreds of years, they would be of Eber. See? And so I think that became normal statement for everybody genetically descended from Eber, even until the time of Abram. Now, it was not enough for him to prepare the people himself, because he needed to make sure that his neighbors weren't thinking of attacking him. And so he would offer friendship. He would say, I have my 300 men that are trained, that are in good shape. They have learned how to handle the spear and so on. And I've read about the people who handle the spear. You think about a sword on the end of a long stick. They would slash and throw. It wasn't just for throwing, for stabbing and slicing and so on. I mean, there was a lot of things. I don't even know if they had spears, but I'm guessing they did. So he had made friends with the Amorites that were by him. Now, evidently, they had a mutual agreement, this confederacy, to aid each other in case of attack. That would make each one of them more powerful by the collection of them all. See, you fight me, you fight us all, the confederacy. So, I imagine, he dispatched runners to Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, and the runners communicated, Lot has been taken, I am going after him, help if you can. I am impressed that they came. This is a personal matter. See? So I'm thinking more than just possible monetary gain. They had to recognize they were the little guys up against the big guys. This was a four-kingdom coalition that was practiced in invasion. I don't think they were the type of people I'd like to mess with, you know? So impressively they came. My question is this, what did they learn of Abram during the time of living by him? Did they consider that very likely this man was blessed of God, and if he decided to go after them, I want to see this. I want to be there. I want to be a part of this. You know, God's on his side. I wonder if he had been a godly influence on them. If they, in fact, were a godly influence on the other Amorites. There was a bit of a godly influence somewhere along the way here. Because God is going, in the next chapter, God is going to talk to Abram about a time when that godly influence is all gone. But it wasn't yet. Genesis 15:16, God says to him, But in the fourth generation, they, your family, shall come hither again, come back to the promised land. For, why the delay? For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. You see? At this time, as he's talking to Abram, their iniquity wasn't full. So perhaps these men had been influenced by Abram in a godly sense, more than just a political and agricultural and financial way. I want you to notice something else about Abram here. Notice his absolute authority he had over his tribe. This was the form of God's mediatorial kingdom during the lifetime of Abram. If you recognize that God had been dealing with everybody individually, and then he said, my spirit will not always strive with to deal with individually these men. I'm going to have the flood. After the flood, God initiates human government, and he emphasizes that with the Tower of Babel. He breaks mankind apart into individual tribes and nations that speak different languages. So he divided them up, scattered them out, and God is dealing now with nations. And then he chooses one person to build a new nation. He chooses Abram. Now, this was the one through whom the Christ would come, the Messiah, the seed, the promised seed. So this was the one that God gave special attention to. In the greatest sense, of all the nations of the world at this time, the one who was actually taking the rule of God to man, it was Abram. It was his group. They were showing the world what faith in the true God was like. They're the ones showing what would be possible if God blessed you. So this is a form of the mediatorial kingdom. And in that sense, he's taking his rule from God. We're going to find here that he talks about this plan to go after Lot, that he was talking to God about it. It doesn't say, but I'm taking that this, the man of faith that God honors, and it's recognized as God honoring them, because on a physical basis they shouldn't have won, but they did. God is honoring him, and I'm thinking that God was leading this in some way for him to do this. It tells me also that love isn't always just quiet and passive. That sometimes true love motivates people to fight. When you take your child to the doctor, you're asking the doctor to fight the disease that's hurting your child, you see. So love sometimes must fight and injure those who harm the loved ones. This is happening here. So he comes to his men and he says, the thing that we've been dealing with, practicing with, all those karate moves that I taught you, all those things that I've learned, that you've learned, it's time to go. I think of it as 318 elite force trained slaves, and they take off after these conquerors. Probably wouldn't be hard to follow the trail, you know. A lot of feet, a lot of animals, all these things being taken. The lighter force, the fact that it's a smaller group, could move more quickly than this ponderous army with their goods and their hostages. So it's not too surprising that they catch up with them. And this is encamped at Dan, the north of Canaan. Now he gets there, and the normal procedure seems to be that you fight during the daylight when you can see what's going on. So he has this strategy, whether he was told to do this by God. We find later God does give some of the generals strategies like this. However it worked out, he decides to attack them at night. And he decides, with his few people, to actually divide them into two parts and attack on opposing sides. I don't know if you can just imagine what that's like. These are the people who conquered everybody. Giants fell to these people. Everywhere they went, people just dove into tar pits to get out of their way. Nobody wants to mess with us. I'm thinking they're relaxed. They're almost out of Canaan now. They're going to travel that rather peaceful route of the Fertile Crescent back to home, triumphant with all their goods and all their stuff and all their people, all the slaves. I'm thinking they kick back. I'm thinking they enjoyed a long drink of some of the stuff they took. Then there was an attack in the night. You can't see how many there are. And so let's grab our weapons and run out the other way and assemble. But when they got out to the other side of the camp, they were attacked from that side. And now they don't know where to go. Absolute confusion. Some of them says, I'm out of here. And they're throwing down their stuff and taking off running. But it was a slaughter. That's the word God uses in this. They came in and they wiped out these invaders. In the darkness, two armies have attacked us. We didn't hear them coming. We didn't see them coming. So it guaranteed confusion. It guaranteed fear in those who assumed that the fighting was over. Definitely caught them off guard, and they fled. So he chases them. The ones that are left, he chases them. And they leave the whole area, and they run and run and run until they can't run anymore. And he dealt with the last of them up by Hobah, which is north of Damascus. So with the enemy dead or perhaps dispersed, Abram now has the people who were hostages perhaps gather up now their own stuff and pack it up, and they begin leading everybody back down the Jordan River Valley peacefully and back home. They travel all the way down to where they're fairly close to where modern-day Jerusalem is. And we find this described in verses 17 to 20, the return from war. Here's the verses. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer and of the kings that were with him at the valley of Shaveh. This is where they met them, which is the king's dale. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. The question we would ask at this point is he a priest of something that he thinks is a Most High God, or the Most High God? We get that answer. And he, Melchizedek, blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of the Most High God. So we get the idea of which God that we're talking about here. And he calls this God possessor of heaven and earth. And he blessed be, Melchizedek continues, the Most High God, which did what? Which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And he, Abram, gave him, Melchizedek, tithes of all. Tithe is a tenth. So it's the new king of Sodom, by the way. The other one, perhaps a sandal still floating on a tar pit someplace, but the new king of Sodom and the king Melchizedek. What a great name. Melchizedek is Melchizedek, the Lord of Righteousness. Isn't that a great name? That doesn't necessarily mean that's what he was because of the name. We have a man later, Adonai Zedek, which even a stronger name, but he was a bad guy. But he was the king of the city of Salem. They came to honor the victorious leader and his fighting men and to received the rescued hostages from the cities of the Vale. The kings met them at a place called the Valley of Shaveh. Shaveh means a level plain. Later, as Moses tells the people that he's writing to, it was called the King's Dale. And if you are familiar with your Israel history, this is the valley where Absalom would later erect a monument for himself in the King's Dale. But it was right outside of Jerusalem. Melchizedek refreshed the army with food and drink and pronounced the blessing on Abram and on God for such a victory. I want you to notice in those words that he recognized that Abram's victory was miraculous. He doesn't say you were so tough you beat him and God gave you the strength. He says God delivered your enemies to you. This was a salvation of God. So the David and Goliath thing here was obvious. It was God doing it. Since Abraham had gathered, we're going to find that he refused to take anything that came from Sodom. So we have to think of what else he took. All the stores of the conquering army, all the things that they had gathered from the giants' cities and stuff like that, those great big chairs or whatever it was that they had there. He had gathered everything that was of value, and he had all of that. So from that pile, he took a tenth, and normally that means not just a tenth, but the top of the heap, the best of the best. And so about a tenth of it all, he handed over to Melchizedek, not because he was a good guy, but because he was the priest of the Most High God. He didn't touch the stuff of Sodom. I don't think Melchizedek would have wanted it, and he didn't either. The question has been asked, where is the Salem? And the geography of the place and so on, the best guess is that the Salem of Melchizedek must be Jerusalem. He brought refreshments, although we find out, because Abram's going to mention it, that the men who had run all the way north, gone quickly, all the way north of the whole land, had eaten of the stores of the conquered people. They would have been very, very hungry after the great work of running and slaying and all this kind of stuff. So they had eaten. They were not starving. But it was good to come home and have somebody have nourishing food. In the old days, bread was, stone ground, and all the minerals were still there. And you could live on bread and water. You could actually do that. Melchizedek. We find that this becomes an important character in the New Testament, because of a reference in the book of Psalms about the Messiah being after the order of Melchizedek. But right now we don't need to deal with that. We just say, are you surprised that at this time, the day of Abram, that God had a priest who was also the king of a city? And this guy was right. This guy was, correct. This guy knew what he was talking about. He was actually representing Jehovah God. This seems surprising to me. But when we stop to think about it, we learn how God was getting the message of salvation to the people of Canaan. We have discovered before, we know that Job and his friends had an impressive knowledge of God and creation. They lived at the time of Abram. So here we see how it happened. This little glimpse back into the history. Long years before God gave his law to Moses, and long years before he set up the Levitical priesthood, God had chosen certain ones to be his priest. He had raised up priests to communicate his truth. Now, Abram had made confederacy with the Amorites. Surely he knew Melchizedek. They had something much more in common than Abram did with the Amorites. So I think possibly he and Job and the other friends perhaps knew each other. They were all wealthy men, it seems, and so wealthy people get to know each other. So perhaps they worshiped together. We learn later that the promised Messiah would be a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, not according to the priesthood of Levi, but of the priesthood of Melchizedek. So he becomes a very important person, and you have to go to the book of Hebrews for the apostle to explain all that. But let me close with this thought. The fifth point here is the refusal of gain from Sodom. Notice the verses 21 to 24. And the king of Sodom said unto Abram very gently to him, very quietly, very appealingly, don't hurt me. You have all the power now. We have no army left. Give me the persons, Hebrew souls, and take the goods to thyself. You keep all the glittery stuff, he says. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I've already settled this. I have lift up mine hand unto Jehovah, you see the capital L-O-R-D, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth. He calls him the same thing that Melchizedek had called him. That I will not take from a thread, even to a shoe latchet, that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou should sayest, I have made Abram rich. Save only, with this exception, that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men that went with me, and he lists them, these Amorite confederacy men, Anar, Eshcol, Mamre, let them take their portion. For me, I don't want to touch it. I don't want to touch it. Abram displayed a very different attitude toward Sodom than Lot had. You see it? So I don't even want to touch it. I brought it back, but I don't want to touch it. This is, and it calls, I should say, very different from Lot. He refused to accept even a thread. His wealth was known to be a blessing from God, not from Sodom. Now, Abram in his words acknowledged that Jehovah was the Most High God. Why was he called the Most High God? Because he was living in an area where the people had all the kinds of gods. So without, you know, getting into a lot of theology, he just said, well, he's the top one. He's the one in charge. I'm wondering, because he talked to God about this, if he says, if you give me the victory in this, and I come back, I'm going to be the only power. I could, if you'd like, take over Sodom and Gomorrah. We know that they are wicked and exceedingly great wicked. We know that. I could take over. I could change that. I could straighten things out. I'm just imagining now. But somewhere in this, God said, no, 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 that's not it. See, you keep your hand off. God says, Abram says, okay, I will. He made a vow. He pledged to God that he would take nothing away from Abram, from Sodom. The irony, I think, is this. If you just stop to think about it. Abram saved Sodom and Gomorrah from destruction, didn't he? See this? By a miracle of warfare. Yet, in a little time, God would destroy them both because they gave no thanks to God. See, he taught them here that God had the power and God had the love to save them, but they would not keep him in their thinking. They rejected this revelation. So all that Abram was willing to take from the return bounty was for his partners in the fight. He lists them, expresses his will that they receive their due, and he also allowed for the missing food that fed the combined army as they traveled back home. What an exciting story. What a powerful indication that Abram is not just this quiet shepherd abiding by himself and coming out and looking at sheep, and that's it. He was a man of the times and prepared for the day. When it was necessary, he could be as tough as anybody. But more than his toughness, we see in this God's power to rule. God showing the power of his kingdom through this one man and his tribe, his little kingdom. Abram at war and blessed. He came back with a triumphal entry, didn't he? And was received and honored by God, by the high priest. Let's bow for prayer. Father, you speak to us of times of trouble, and because Lot had lost any stand of faithfulness to thee, he was included in that which was taken. But Abram, standing firm and standing with a firm stand against the sinful things, can be used to actually undo that problem and to rescue Lot and the others. Father, we are perhaps especially amazed at your loving grace to Sodom and Gomorrah. As many have criticized you for your destruction of them, we see here your loving kindness and your rescue of them. For you took your man and gave him a miraculous victory over what must have been an overwhelming army. I ask, Father, that you might help us to see that you're not out to kill sinners, that you're out to give them the opportunity of turning in repentance to thee, of gaining salvation. I pray that you might help us then recognize that we ought to do the same. For Abram did not distinguish between who he saved. He brought them all back. I ask that you might help us then to share your love, even for the sinner, even when we don't like or approve or want to participate at all in what they do. We will love them for their fellow humans with a soul that will live someplace forever. I ask that you might guide and direct us then in the path of faith, as you did Abram, that we would be very clear about where we get our wealth and our goods, that it's a provision of you, and we don't have to go to the sinful areas to increase our wealth. In fact, we refuse to do that. With heads bowed, eyes closed, it may be that you're saying, I see that Abram, by being faithful, was honored by God. By turning everything over to him, God worked it out in the best possible way. The question is that what you're doing? As the difficulties crowd around you, as I know they must, to whom are you turning? Is it just to self? Are you turning to him? Are you telling him about it? Are you letting him make the right decision? Perhaps you say, Pastor, this is something that I need to change. I need to take it to the Lord. I need to tell him my difficulties. Let him handle these things. Pray for me. Would you slip your hand up? Say, pray for me. I need to set this before God. Father, how we thank you for this story that encourages us to be brave when we know we stand for the truth. Guide and direct each one of us. Keep us well and safe this day. Bring us back to honor thee with the service tonight. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.